Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we're in Provincetown for a conversation with author Alex Kotlowitz and former New York Magazine editor Adam Moss, presented by 20 Summers at the historic Hawthorne Barn. Alex Kotlowitz is the author of four books, including the national bestseller There Are No Children Here, selected by the New York Public Library as one of the 150 most important books of the 20th century. His most recent book, An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago, tackles the subject of youth poverty and gun violence in urban America. Alex Moss was editor-in-chief of New York Magazine from 2004 until he stepped down in March. During his tenure, New York Magazine won 40 National Magazine Awards. Moss oversaw a vast digital expansion for parent company New York Media that led to the creation of five other publications, reaching 50 million visitors each month.
So hello, everybody. Thank you for coming out. We're here to talk to Alex about An American Summer, his new book about journalism. But why don't we just first, I don't know how many of you have actually read this book, and let's so that we can sort of set a marker about what we're going to talk about. And Alex, why don't you just start by describing what the book is?
Sure. So I kind of, in some ways, think about this book as kind of a bookend to There Are No Children Here, which I wrote some 28 years ago, and is was mentioned, you know, about a couple of young boys growing up in the projects, and about all that's bearing down on them, and it's about sort of this, what it means to this profound poverty in, you know, the world's most prosperous nation. And one of the things that for me was really unsettling was the violence in their life. And what has distressed me and unsettled me even more is the stubborn persistence of the violence over the years, over these intervening years. And so this book was really an effort to try, as intimately as I could, to try to sort of understand what the violence does to the spirit of individuals and the spirit of community. It's about how the violence gets in your bones. And I set out to use the scaffolding for the book. The conceit of the book was the idea that I would take one summer in Chicago and tell a collection of stories from this one summer. And so this is a collection of 14 stories. Some of the stories course through the summer, some of them are self-contained, that speak to really how the violence gets in your bones, how it comes to shape you, and how you do all you can to keep it from defining you.
Yeah, I should say that it's an extraordinary book. Really, I can say that, because he won't. And among other things, it is incredibly intimate. Basically, the construction, as Alex said, is of these weekends over the course of the summer, and each weekend has another story attached to it, and occasionally some of the stories reattach. And then he tells these stories in incredible novelistic detail and with remarkable sympathy. It is very hard to read this book without weeping. And it is, you know, some people have experienced the book as harrowing and bleak in that sense, because it's about something so awful and persistent. But, there's also a great deal of life in it, because the stories mostly that Alex is telling are stories of survivors. And that's just to give a little more color to what you...
Well, I can't tell you how much this means coming from you. It does.
It's but, totally true. But I kind of want to know, so, you know, you wrote this classic book of nonfiction, There Are No Children Here, and this is in a way a sequel, many years later, roughly the same area. So why did you decide to return to this, and why did you decide to tell the story as a collection of stories as opposed to, like, the first book centered on a single family?
Right. So, you know, it became clear to me, I remember right after the tragic shooting in Newtown, and then it happened again in Parkland, you know, I felt like we were asking all the right questions, you know, not the least of which is, you know, how do these individuals and how does the community move forward after bearing the burden of this tragedy? And so I realized, I mean, we don't ask those questions in places like Chicago or St. Louis or Detroit or New Orleans. I mean, I could go on city after city. And the other thing is that I was personally, I mean, over the years, I've been personally touched by the violence. Some of the kids, not the main characters, but some of the kids I got to know have since been killed. And one of them particularly haunts me, a young man who, Jojo Meeks, I used to take Lafayette and Faro fishing.
They're the two main characters.
Yeah. And I used to take them fishing once a year, and I would take Jojo would join us, and Jojo had this smile that was so wide you felt like you could walk into it. And years later, he was shot and killed. He was held apparently was a, he became a kind of a stick-up artist and had stuck up some drug dealers who were better armed than him. But I didn't learn about it until after his funeral, and I really, to this day, it haunts me that I wasn't at his funeral. I mean, I just sort of, it's kind of stayed with me. And so I really wanted, and I felt like we weren't asking these questions, and so I wanted to try to, as intimately as I could, try to sort of understand what it does to the soul of individuals. I mean, the book I thought about when I was beginning to think about this was Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, you know, which is, if you haven't read it, it's a, you know, Tim O'Brien was a Vietnam veteran, and it's a novel, informed by his experience, and it's a story about a single platoon. And the one thing that he does so beautifully in the book is each chapter is a story about a different member of the platoon, and you have the characters who reappear. And I think one of the reasons that he did that was that he realized, in order to capture the breadth of the experience, that to tell the story of one individual wouldn't serve it justice. And so I felt the same way, that I couldn't, there wasn't a single narrative I felt that could capture what was at work here. And so I set out to find these stories, and I was looking for stories that kind of upended what I thought I knew, stories that surprised me on some level, to think about the violence, to think about how, again, how it comes to shape people. And as you say, I mean, the thing I came to learn and reasonably quickly is it was impossible to write about death without celebrating life. I mean, for the most part, these are all people who are still standing erect in this world slumping around them.
So, but what, let's talk about, we had a sort of pregame conversation in which Alex just said, be fun to talk about craft. So let's talk about craft a little bit. So here you are, or process is another way of putting it. You know, here you are, you've got this goal of writing this book. You go in, you're a white guy. You go into this vast, scarred community. How did you go about looking for subjects? And how did you go about choosing the subjects? And what were you looking for in their stories?
I mean, the thing I always say, and you understand this as well as anyone, is that, you know, given what we do, nature of what we do as journalists, we're always outsiders, you know, if not by race or class, by gender, age, geography, religion, politics, you name it. And clearly, I mean, you know, I go into these neighborhoods and I'm clearly an outsider by race and by class. But there are also places that I've spent a lot of time over the last 30 years, and so I've built up these friendships and connections. And so one of the first things I did was to sort of reach out to people I knew. I spent time that summer in a trauma unit. I embedded with a homicide unit all summer, which I can talk about later, which I ended up not using any of. But I tried as best I could to sort of reach out into all these areas looking for stories. And I wasn't, to be honest, I wasn't clear what I was looking for. I think of the old Justice Stewart adage, which is, you know, when he talked about pornography, he's going to, I know it when I see it. And that's sort of how I felt about these stories, is that I felt like I would know it when I saw it. And I was looking again for stories that surprised me. I was looking for people that on some level interested me because of either what they've experienced or because of their ability to reflect or their level of self-awareness. I was naive going in. I thought initially that I had this idea that I would do one summer. It would be a fairly easy book to report. I would report it through the summer, maybe another 6 months, and then sit down and write. And of course, and I say again, this was naive of me, but the stories that I landed on, many of them kind of unfurled over time, and it was impossible to not follow them through. And of course, as they unraveled, they revealed so much more about the people that I had gotten to know.
Were you looking specific? I mean, you know, for those of you who've read the book, will maybe agree with this, but the stories really are mostly of people who are struggling to get out of the life, or have achieved getting out of the life. And in that way, the story, the book is kind of upbeat. It's not, you know, there's not a lot of subjects that are, I mean, you don't dwell on the subjects. They appear in the book who are just perpetrating awfulness. You know, mostly you find people who you know, who are trying to find their your own humanity.
Right.
In this. And was that what you were looking for? Or?
Well, except that I think that that's sort of, you know, there's this kind of, you know, there's this notion that, you know, there's this all this good and evil in the world. And the truth of the matter is we all fall somewhere
right,
between. In between. And so people are complicated and, you know, rich and full. And there are people, I think, I mean, in the end, you know, the question I ask myself, because these are people I end up spending a lot of time with, right. These people that I want to hang out with. Because my because my feeling is if I don't want to hang out with them, readers aren't going to want to hang out with them. Yeah. And so I guess there is that kind of unstated bias going in. That, but I think that the people that I spend time with are representative. It's not to say that there aren't people out there who, you know, who are just, for whatever reason, disturbed in their own manner. But I think people struggle. They struggle with who they are. It's just
so it's really a nature of your own, what you bring to the party in some ways, that as opposed to you looking for specifically stories of redemption.
Right. Yeah. In fact, one of the things I love about writing, and also the thing that's so hard about writing, is that's when you sort of sit down and try to make sense of everything you've come across. So it's not like I say, oh, this is a great story because it's about forgiveness or redemption or what. But it's not until I sit down and I begin to make sense of the stories that it becomes clear why I was so drawn to it.
Right. Now, so many of the subjects of the book are withdrawn, taciturn, have a lot of trouble expressing themselves, are quite traumatized. And yet, here is a book full of a kind of intimate testimony, but you know, that you were able to get out of them. So what, and even in the face in certain situations where their mother can't get them to speak,
right.
That they're completely shut down.
Right.
What is it that you as a journalist are able to do in order to gain their trust?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a clear answer to that, but you're right. I mean, it was one of the things that was really hard about this book as I was asking people to reflect on what for them had been this, probably this most painful, sorrowful moment in their life. And so, and for many of them, if not almost all, they had never talked about it before. It was this, the thing that was clear to me about almost all the people I spent time with in this book was this kind of utter sense of loneliness, you know, this feeling that nobody could possibly understand what I've experienced and what I've been through. But I found people were kind of conflicted in some ways because they, on the one hand, they had held on to these, you know, stories. But I do think there's something incredibly, as going to sound maybe glib, but there's something really therapeutic about telling your story, about trying to make sense of it. Again, I think about Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carry. There's a line towards the end of the book where he writes, you know, this much I know to be true, stories can save us. And I think that O'Brien was talking as much to his readers as he was to himself.
Yeah.
And so I think that was the case with most of the people I spent time with. I mean, one of the stories I always think about, there's a short story in the book about George Spivey, you know, a guy who he's been in prison for 12 years. He goes in when his son is 7, and when he gets out, his son is about to graduate from high school, and he wants to rebuild, more than anything, wants to rebuild his relationship with his son, and he gets out, and they begin to do that. They begin to reconnect, and then his son is killed in a case of mistaken identity, and so George was just heartbroken, and so, I, you know, I talked to him over the course of a number of months, and then, as is my wont, I sort of, when I began to right, I kind of disappeared, and 6 months later, I got a text from him saying, Alex, where you been? I haven't heard from you. And I thought, oh, this is great, because I need to go talk to him about some other stuff, and I went over to his house and talked for another 45 minutes, and at the end of the 45 minutes, he starts looking at his watch and says, you know, I got to be somewhere. And I realized he was just really conflicted. On the one hand, he really wanted me there to talk about it, and the other hand, he was done. He just, you know, wanted to be left alone.
What did they, I mean, did, you know, some of these kids are very young. What did they understand you were doing?
There were only two young people in the book, and both of them were in high school. And one of them, by the time I finished reporting, he was in his early 20s, so he understood. There is the story of Marcelo, who's, when I first meet him, he's 16. And I worried a little bit about sort of what he understood. I would go over and over and over with him about sort of what I was going to write about in the book, because one of the things that's, you know, the other part of this is I spend so much time with people, is you build these relationships. You know, they're complicated, but you build these relationships and you don't want to at any point feel like you've betrayed somebody's confidence, you know? And so one thing, I always have my notebook out, but moreover, especially with young people, I try to just go over and over the fact that I'm going to use this in the book, and I make sure that there's nothing that's going to surprise them. So it's a responsibility.
Is there part of you that fears your, this is a rough word, but exploiting them for your own craft?
Yeah, I want to be clear. Yeah, I mean, it's everybody. So often when I am working on,
I didn't feel that as a reader. Because you're such a sensitive person.
No, it's a really fair question. Yeah. And what I was going to say is that often when I'm working on a book, even a magazine piece, one of the questions I often get asked by people, am I going to get paid? And I really think what people are asking is, what's in it for me, which is what they should be asking, mm-hmm. you know? And so I'm writing about people who are private individuals. They've got no obligation to talk to me. I'm there. It's a privilege to be there with them and to be invited into their life. And so one of the things I try to do, and I don't always succeed at this, but I try to sort of help them understand why not only do they want to share their story with me, but why they want to share it in this really public way. And I don't always succeed, but I try as best I can, because it's the question they should be asking.
Yeah. At New York Magazine, we published a piece of this book, which Alex can tell you what that story is. But one of the things that happened in it is that after we published it, Alex asked us to take it out of digital circulation. So it was published in the physical magazine, and of course it's a part of the book, but he asked us to take it out of the easily accessible world of the internet, because the subjects of, or a subject of the article was frightened and felt vulnerable because of it, and which we did, and you know, to a little bit of finger wagging from some journalism purists. But why don't you? But it was not a hard call for me anyway to make if this person was feeling frightened. But it's sort of an interesting case study.
Yeah.
And so why don't you?
Sure. Yeah. And I want to say, and I mean this, that I remember when I finally sort of thought, you know, I really need to sort of make this ask of the magazine, that I actually thought they were going to say no. So,
did have a big internal dialogue about it, because it's a sort of something we don't ever do.
Right.
It's like, and one is accused of sort of trying to erase the record, erase history by doing this. But in this case, there was a kid who was scared. It just didn't seem like there was a question.
Well, but anyway, I was going to say, I felt like you guys did the honorable thing. And so, so this is a story of a young man, Romain Hill, who, when he was 19, he was a kid who was graduated from high school. He was working at a local grocery store in the meat department. He was, you know, just a good kid. I mean, he had a girlfriend, and so he and his girlfriend are out one night, standing by a car, cleaning out a car that belonged to a friend, so they could go to a party, and a 15-year-old boy pedals by on a bicycle and starts shooting at them, aiming at the owner of the car, and ends up shooting Romain in the back. And Romain survives, but he does something pretty remarkable, which is that he IDs the shooter to the police, and then agrees to testify. And as a result, the kid ends up realizing that he's going to lose a trial, ends up pleading guilty, and ends up serving 15 years. And over the course of the next year or two, Romain is constantly threatened by friends and family members of this boy. He's offered money to recant. He's told that he needs to, you know, recant. At one point, they try to kidnap him. What he did in some ways was kind of heroic, but I think he just felt like he had done the right thing and there wasn't anything more to be done, and he just wanted to get on with his life. And then one afternoon, a Saturday afternoon, at 1:30 in the afternoon in Seward Park, which is a fairly gentrified part of Chicago, Romain's on his way to work. He's got his headphones on, so he can't hear anything. And a guy comes up behind him and puts a gun to his head and executes him in this park. And there are all these witnesses. You know, there's a mother who's getting out of her car. There's a postal worker, a guy going to Starbucks. Plus, there are all these terraces. I mean, it's just a beautiful neighborhood. And the thing about it is that nobody will come forward. Everybody's afraid. I mean, it's a story about this sort of underlying ripple of fear in these communities. And so the story is about Romain, and it's also about his brother and his sister, especially about his brother, who's deeply unmoored by Romain's death. In fact, there's a moment when his brother says to me, nobody can understand what I'm going through. I mean, it's this moment that I spoke about earlier where this feeling he just felt utterly alone. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time with the family. I spent a lot of time with the detective and others in this piece. And so, I'd given everybody, when I got advanced copies of the book, one of the things I did was to personally drop off copies to everybody in the book. And it was both an exhilarating moment and also really unnerving, because you think you worry about the critics, but you really worry about the people you wrote about. So they actually had read, or I think they had read their chapters, and then New York Magazine was interested in excerpting, and I went to the family and I just said, you know, are you okay with this? And they were. And I think one of the things that I didn't anticipate, and I didn't mention to them, was the fact that it was going to be on the web. And I think, you know, the ubiquitous nature of the web, that it unnerved them, that they began to get Facebook posts from people, and the brother and the sister actually both felt unsafe. And that was ultimately why I asked to pull it down. But it speaks to this fear that just undergirds some of these communities in the city.
You're listening to a conversation with author Alex Kotlowitz and former New York Magazine editor Adam Moss, recorded at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. We'll have more after a break. Welcome back to The Point. More now of a conversation with author Alex Kotlowitz and former New York Magazine editor Adam Moss at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown.
The introduction to this book is in which Alex is explaining why he wrote the book. He uses the story of one of the main figures in There Are No Children Here, Pharaoh, in order to explain how the violence has stayed with him and all these years. But of course, to me, the most extraordinary aspect of the foreword of the book is the description of the fact that Pharaoh, one of the characters in this book, was taken in by Alex and his wife and lived with them for many, many years. And Alex sent this kid to school and was a father in some sense to this this kid, which is, you know, kind of amazing in journalism. It just doesn't happen. And then I noticed that one of the class that Alex teaches at Northwestern, or will teach, I'm not sure.
I teach, yeah.
Yeah, that you teach, is called The Journalism of Empathy. And I want to understand what that means.
Sure.
Even though I kind of have a sense of it.
But. Yeah. So I want to be clear, which I'd love to talk about, but I do think it's different than... Well, no, I did take Pharaoh in, and my wife, bless her heart, because I was single at the time when he came... Initially, he came in, it was going to be a few days, and a few days turned into 6 years. And I was single at the time, and then when I got married, my wife, bless her heart, was open to the idea of Pharaoh moving in with us, as staying with us. But... You know, one of the things I love about my work, one of the perks is you, with many of the people, not all the people I write about, you know, they become a part of my life. And I feel my life is so much richer and fuller for that. And Pharaoh is kind of the extreme example of that. And I feel this is done, Pharaoh moved in with us after the book came out. One of the things I want to be clear about is that, you know, when you've got this relationship with the people you're writing about, again, it can be complicated. And I feel like if there are lines that are crossed, and they are often crossed, and it's the thing that you are obligated as a writer is just to be upfront with your readers. I feel that really in the end is what's most important. But this notion of empathy for me is, I mean, what I'm after in my work is to try, and I want to be clear that, you know, the distinction between empathy and sympathy, it's not feeling sorry for someone, it's this capacity to imagine yourself as someone else, to be able to place yourself on someone else's shoes. And understand why people, what pushes and pulls at them, what motivates them, and why they make the choices they do, sometimes choices that don't on the surface seem reasonable or logical. And so as a writer, it's what I'm after. I mean, it's this centripetal force of storytelling. I mean, it's what literature is about, is this, you know, is this, again, this capacity to put yourself in the place of someone else. It's what transports you. And it's, you know, we talk about being transported in books or movies. Really, what we're talking about is, again, this notion of of empathy. And then the other part of it is there, you know, I write to be read, and so I'm not writing for myself. And so when I sit down to write, I'm trying to find empathy with my reader, you know, trying to think, okay, so where does the reader need to know something? When do they need to know it? You know, I'm trying to put myself in their shoes. But it is what I'm after. And it's hard. I had an early lesson with, when I began to first think about this notion of empathy in any self-conscious way, was actually when I was working on There Are No Children Here. And the boy's mother would disappear a couple of nights a week. She'd go down to the other side of the projects to gamble all night and play cards. And I found out, because I would get phone calls from the boys, they were 12 and 9 years old when I began writing the book. I'd get calls from them in the morning that, you know, that they didn't have any cereal or they didn't have any clean underwear or t-shirts, and because their mom wasn't there. And I got angrier and angrier. And I remember when I sat down to write the book, I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to write about it. And I went for a walk with a friend who was a poet. I was single at the time. She had 4 kids. And she began to lecture me about sort of what it's like to be a mom, what it must be like to be a mom growing up in the projects, and what it must be like to be a single mom growing up in the projects. And she said to me, she said, I'm not justifying what she's doing, but if I had to guess, this is probably the only respite she can get. And she said to me, I remember she wagged her finger in my face. She said, you need to go talk to her about it. And I did, and it was a really hard conversation. But she was right. I mean, and so I had a long back and forth with the mother, with LeJo, about this, that I needed to include this in the book, and that people would, in the context of her life, people would understand it. And but it was about trying to sort of understand why she made this choice that on the surface seems so destructive, so irrational, so illogical.
But is there a line where that kind of empathy is no longer appropriate? I wondered this just because there were times in the book when I struggled with my own sense of judgment. I mean, there's one incredibly harrowing scene of a guy who takes up a lot of real estate in the book, named Eddie, where he's recounting. And in this story, he's basically feeling awful about this. Nevertheless, he is hiding with
right. He's young.
Else.
I mean, he's young. A kid.
He's a kid. He's hiding, having. Right. I don't remember what he did at that point that he was hiding.
Well, they were in an abandoned building, yeah. And he and his friend had gone in there. They were like 12, 13 years yeah. old, and they were just going in to, you right. know, explore it.
Yes. And he would later.
He ended up killing somebody.
And you know that beforehand, and then in this instance, while they're hiding, they are witnesses to a woman being raped, and they do not intervene. Mm-hmm. They do not even yell, or, you know, because they're too afraid of being caught. And of course, I'm like, right. you know, well, I mean, how the book is so understanding.
Right.
And I, at that moment, I thought, well, am I so understanding? But I just wonder about that.
But yeah, but I don't. Yeah, I guess when I think about empathy, I don't think about it as excusing people. Mm-hmm. And so, if in fact you felt that, that's okay. You know, uh-huh. But what I'm after, I mean, they were young. I mean, they were 12 or 13 years mm-hmm. old at the time, and so it's partly about being there in this moment, you know, and just being utterly paralyzed, you know, with fear when they see this woman. She was not only raped, she was brutally raped. And I mean, I guess her rape is brutal, but I mean, it was also, she was also physically beaten. But it's okay to pass judgment, mm-hmm. I mean, as a reader. I think that's, you know, this is the other thing. The beauty of telling stories is, you know, we're not lecturing people, we're not telling people how to think, and right. the beauty of stories is you find your own way. And so you get to the end of a story, and you may find yourself somewhere in a different place than I did. And that's, mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. Yeah.
Well, so just also on the subject of empathy, I mean, I was sort of talking about this book today with David Dunlap, who was a reporter for the New York Times and also is a Provincetown expert and gives walking tours and explains the lore and background of various places. It's amazing. You should go do it. But he's a journalist, and I was sort of talking about this book and talking to Alex, and he was describing and talking about empathy and also something I'd read in which Alex, or the reporter, was using Alex's approach to journalism in opposition to Janet Malcolm's approach to journalism, which he says that all journalists are always selling someone out and all journalism is transactional. And Alex's version of journalism is just 100% the opposite. But anyway, he was saying that he was describing He said, "Oh yeah, you know, when I first started my career, I was doing a project similar to Alex's, in one small sense, which is that he was he and a photographer were in this abandoned building where there were two families left in the building or something like that, and there was no money and it was freezing out, and the way that they heated their apartment was just with a stove, and the gas in the room was so awful, and there were these young, very young children who were clearly about to pass out from this. And his impulse as a journalist was to grab those children and bring them home. Mm-hmm. And your capacity to intervene during the act of journalism and the temptation, especially when you have so much feeling for them. Did you feel that? I mean, you were talking about, like, I was just thinking as you were talking about the mother who was out gambling and right. the kids couldn't eat. I mean, do you go over there and bring them egg McMuffins?
Yeah, I did. No, I brought cereal down.
Yeah.
So, but here's the thing. I think I've kind of progressed some on this. I mean, I've spent mm-hmm. 10 years at the Wall Street Journal and working at an institution like the Journal or New York Magazine. I mean, there are certain obligations you have given the sort of unspoken rules at those places, and you do have to adhere to them. I mean, not the least of which, for example, money can't exchange hands, and you know you're there as a journalist. But writing books, which is a kind of commercial enterprise, feels a little bit different. But I do. There are moments when I sort of think that these journalistic lines, you know, sometimes they're going to get crossed. And again, I feel like the thing that's most important, it's if you're going to cross them, if you do cross them, that you just simply be upfront with your readers and presumably your editors as well. I mean, I'm going to share a story, and I'm not sharing this out of turn because I've had this conversation publicly with Sonia Nazario, who wrote a book called Enrique's Journey. And Sonia was a reporter at the LA Times, and she wrote this book where she about a young boy from Honduras who was left behind by his mom who came into this country, and he ended up riding a really dangerous journey up through Mexico, riding the top of the trains to get to the border, and then he gets to the border and he actually has to make this trip twice, and he eventually gets over. But Sonia first meets Enrique at the border, and he's just made his way up. It's been 3 weeks on top of the trains. It's a harrowing journey. And this kid is waiting to try to for an opportunity to cross the border. He's like 12 or 13. And he more than anything wants to call his grandmother back in Honduras to let her know that he's okay. And Sonia very proudly says that she had a cell phone in her pocket and didn't tell him. And I got into an argument with her about this because I said, well, if it was me, I think I would have given him the phone. And if it changed the trajectory of his story, of his journey, then simply just acknowledge it, just write about it. I think readers are understanding that way. But it is this dilemma I think we have as journalists, you know, especially when we're writing about people who are in incredibly vulnerable positions. So like Dunlap, I mean, his extreme response was to take those kids home, but I'm sure he also must have just wanted to buy them some food,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Or he was describing that. Yeah, case. Right. Yeah. And so mm-hmm. and so where, you know, what are our obligations? And again, this goes back to this question you asked earlier, which is, does it feel really exploitive if you're going into somebody's life and where the stakes are really high and you've got this capacity to, in the moment, perhaps alleviate some duress, you know, what's your obligation?
Right.
I just don't think there are easy answers. Tracy Kidder, who's a dear friend, had the best piece of advice for me once, which was, you're the one who's got to wake up in the morning and look at yourself in the mirror.
Right.
So
that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to a conversation with author Alex Kotlowitz and former New York Magazine editor Adam Moss, recorded at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. More after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. More now of a conversation with author Alex Kotlowitz and former New York Magazine editor Adam Moss at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown.
All right, let's change the subject a little bit and get onto something that you don't want to talk about, which is policy. The book actually, and many, many times, and Alex's really eloquent prose makes a case that this is not a book of policy. He doesn't know why Chicago, of all cities, although he mentions that Chicago is certainly not the only city where this is happening, but why this is happening in Chicago and not New York, although I'm sure he has some theories. and you know, he doesn't know how to fix it. And yet, let's talk about that for a second. So there's a new mayor in Chicago that you're very enthusiastic about. You know, she calls you up for advice. What is your advice?
Let me back up and say, and then I'll tell you this. So I just want to point out that Chicago, as violent as it is not even in the top 10 most violent cities in the country. New York and LA are kind of the outliers, but you look at Baltimore, Philadelphia, Detroit, St. Louis, Kansas City. I mean, I could have written this book in so many different places. So I think, one, we've made a mistake in over the past number of years in seeing this as a law enforcement problem. And it's partly why I think we've created this untenable tension that exists between police and communities of color and communities that are in distress. And it's not to say that law enforcement isn't part of the problem, but it's a mistake to think that they're the problem. So one of the things that for me that's been really encouraging in recent years is this notion of thinking about violence as a public health matter and sort of beginning to reckon with the trauma that kind of underlies these stories. I don't talk about it explicitly. And so I think there are a number of things that need to be done. The one thing that I should say, and I feel even sheepish saying this because it feels so self-evident, but you know, the violence in all these cities, in Chicago and all these other places I mentioned, they're all happening in neighborhoods that are deeply distressed, mm-hmm. and neighborhoods that are in cities that are deeply segregated. So these are communities that are physically and spiritually isolated from the rest of the city. So one thing I think we need to do is to find a way to rebuild these communities and provide some sense of opportunity. That window is not only not widening, but it's narrowed. But the other part of it is I think we've got to deal in a much more explicit way with the trauma, both individual and collective trauma in these communities. And we're beginning to do that. There are some programs around the country that are in a really small way or beginning to tackle this. And I think that actually this is something that the mayor has indicated that she wants to explore. So there's stuff out there that works, but one of the reasons, well, I didn't deal with public policy in this book, one, because it's not my bailiwick. It's not my strength. I recognize that. And also the other thing I'll tell you is that anybody who tells you they know what works is lying, because we haven't figured that out. I mean, the other issue, of course, is just the accessibility of guns, you know, mm-hmm. which is not a local issue, it's a national issue. And Chicago is a kind of prime example of that. Chicago's got pretty restrictive gun laws, but the surrounding counties in Indiana have very loose gun laws, and so it's extraordinarily easy to get guns. Having said that, even if tomorrow we decided that we weren't going to manufacture any more weapons in this country, there's still 300 million guns out there. So that is not going to change things overnight, but the accessibility of guns is a real issue. So I think there are all these ways in, and then holding the police more accountable. The tension now in Chicago between the police and communities of color is untenable. I don't know. I mean, we've got to reckon with that in a really direct way. It's one of the things that is interesting about Lori Lightfoot. You know, she began her career as a prosecutor, and she was a tough prosecutor. I mean, I've heard from defense attorneys who were up against her. She was really, really tough. And she went into private practice and then became the head of the board that looks at police cases in the city. And one of the things for me is impressive about Lori, I mean, I think it was transformative. And for a politician to have this kind of transformative experience that she's not static speaks a lot to who she is.
Let's talk about the police for a second, because sure. it's the chapter you didn't write. You embedded with the police department. There's kind of two different ways that the police show up in the book. In one case, very horrifically, they've gunned down an innocent kid, and never held accountable for that at all. It's really an amazing and horrible story, as horrible as so many of the famous incidents. And then there's another in which you find a cop who's just very kind of sympathetic explains his own frustration, where basically people in the community do not help the police, and he completely understands why. So there you spend a lot of time with them. You're basically an empathetic person. What did you learn about the police department that you didn't write about?
Right. I pleaded and begged with the police department to let me embed with a homicide unit, and they said, you could have 3 days, but of course, This is the kind of trick of journalists, is once I was in, I wasn't leaving. So I ended up spending the summer with this unit, seven detectives, and two of them I got very reasonably close to, one of them in particular, a Hispanic detective in his 40s. You know, I will tell you that one of the things about that experience is it felt so familiar, and there was something really meta about it. My nickname there was Castle, and for those of you who are not familiar with it, Castle is this TV show of a journalist who's embedded with a homicide unit. So that was sort of how, and I felt like what I was seeing, I knew already. And what interested me really was with this, especially with this Hispanic detective, he'd been doing it for quite a while, working as a homicide detective. We'd go out to lunch on his days off, and he'd have a Bloody Mary at lunch. And I knew that it was that the violence, that what he was seeing was getting to him. And what I really wanted to do was to do a really intimate story about a police officer. And he wouldn't let me in. Yeah. Well, it's not that he wouldn't let me do it. He wouldn't let me in. I don't think he was at a place where he was ready to acknowledge what had happened. And it was hard. I mean, as a result of the time with them, I was turned on to some stories in the book because of the time with them. But I just felt like I wasn't learning anything. And I felt like, and again, this is, you know, I felt like if it felt like this to me, that my readers would feel this as well, that if I wrote about this time with the detectives, that readers would read it and think, well, I've read this already, or I've seen it on TV, and that's sort of how it felt to me. And I've tried since to think about if there's anything to do with all the material I got, and there isn't. And it's one of the things about reporting is it's really messy. And I'm sure there are reporters out there who are much more efficient than I am, but every time I start a project, I think, okay, I'm going to be really efficient about it. And then, you know, you get really disoriented. You spend time following these leads, or in this case, these detectives, and the material just kind of disappears.
You're talking about the you being interested in the trauma of the experience by this police officer. So much of the book is obviously about the trauma experienced by the residents of the neighborhood. There's a character in the book who's a journalist who you also talk right. about his trauma. So let's talk about yours. You've now spent much of your life dealing in these situations which are so sad and bleak and difficult. You know, what sort of toll do you think it's taken on
Well,
you?
this book got to me. So there was when I sat down to write, I had some structural issues with the book that really were kind of completely had me tied up in knots, and I kind of got paralyzed at a moment, and it got real, and I've never had this experience before, and though for those who have suffered from depression, I'm sure this will feel familiar, but with this period where I felt no joy, I couldn't smile. I remember visiting some friends in Seattle, and it was just, I just didn't want to be there. And as you said, I think of myself as a reasonably optimistic person. And I ended up going into therapy, and I realized what was really going on was this kind of visceral or secondary trauma that I was experiencing. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that pulled me out is the catharsis of telling stories, is that I was able, I mean, it's like I go back to what Tim O'Brien says, the stories save us. And I think in some ways, this sounds overdramatic, but in some ways they saved me. I mean, I was able to tell their stories. But it wasn't until well afterwards that I realized sort of what I was experiencing and why. So, and as I think I've said publicly, I think I'm sure I will find my way to continue to write about these issues, but I don't think I want another long project. In fact, my film agent called a few weeks ago and said somebody was interested in doing a TV series where I would go out and kind of be a reporter and go into these neighborhoods, and I said, I can't do it. I just can't, you know. I mean, it didn't interest me for a number of reasons, but one of them is I don't know that I could emotionally dive into that again.
The 20 Summers season runs through mid-June at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. You can find out more information about upcoming performances at 20summers.org. Today's show was recorded and mixed by Brian Morris. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point with production assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.